Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times and Darren Lewis of the Daily Mirror. Liverpool may need a favour from a certain Brendan Rodgers if they're to win the Premier League, but their fate is in their own hands at the Camp Nou on Wednesday. Barcelona dominate La Liga. They've just won their eighth title in 11 years. They've even taken to using Lionel Messi as an occasional impact sub. But this Liverpool team has a different mentality. They'll fancy their chances, won't they, Johnny?
I think they will. I mean, I fancy their chances too. I mean, when you're facing a team that's got Lionel Messi in it, of course you can take nothing for granted. He has the ability to take any game or tie away from you. But there's quite a few things in Liverpool's favour. I think the way the tie works out is perfect for them. Playing at the Camp Nou first gives them the opportunity to employ the Anfield factor, of course, in the second leg. I think if you watch Barca against Manchester United, there was a big gulf in their performance between what they did at Old Trafford and what they did on their home patch. So I think if Liverpool can survive this week reasonably intact, they'll be in a great position. And what they've got is this incredible team ethic. They've got fabulous energy and intensity about them. The very things that I think an ageing, slightly for me, disorganised, unshapen Barcelona side. I know they've just won La Liga again, but I'm going on what I've seen in Europe. All those sort of things that they might be vulnerable to. And really, you know, often we do overblow individuals. I think this one is actually quite simple. If they can somehow control Messi, then the tie is theirs for me.
Because if you look at Barcelona, Darren, okay, Valverde is pretty universally underestimated in terms of he's been there 2 years, they've won two titles. Under his guidance, they've not lost the game against a top nine club in La Liga. But what does that tell us when push comes to shove on the real stage, which is the Champions League?
Well, so far, his organisation, the players respect his organisation. And shortly after he came, he went on a couple of quite long unbeaten runs. He's not had the most distinguished career as an individual himself. He's only 55. But what he did do, I mean, for example, he was at Olympiacos. He won a couple of Super Leagues there. He left. He went somewhere else where it didn't work out. They asked for him to come back, went back, won another Super League, won the cup as well. And as soon as he went to Barcelona, he imposed the way that he wanted to play on the side straight away. I think he's underestimated because he doesn't have the profile of some of his predecessors. But what he does have is the respect to the players that are playing under him. And I don't think it is all about Messi. It's a collective will in that team that does enable Barcelona to dominate in La Liga and obviously to take the power away from Real Madrid, who have kind of fallen way below their usual standards and do need re-energising. I think what helps Liverpool is the fact that they may well approach this game in the same way that they approached Manchester City, a side that was last season imperious and nobody really knew how to fight against them and tended to park the bus, and Liverpool fought fire with fire. And I can see this being quite a high-scoring affair because Liverpool will say, let's not worry about them. Let them worry about us. They've got three forwards now at the top of their game. And Firmino, there is obviously that suggestion he has that injury, isn't there? So it remains to be seen whether that's bluff or whether that's serious, and we won't see Firmino for the remainder of the season. But certainly, as far as Liverpool are concerned, I think they'll look at City and how everyone believed City were invincible and think to themselves, we got past them, we can get past Barca.
Is that an interesting comparison, Johnny? Because if you look at the City side of last year, certainly, There were defensive frailties. There are defensive frailties in this current Barca team, aren't there?
Yeah, I think Dan makes a very good point. And you saw in that United first leg at Old Trafford, they started off just trying to contain Barca. They were too kind of respectful. There was a point about half an hour in, they were already 1-0 down, where they realised, wait a minute, this lot aren't, particularly at the back, they aren't actually as sort of elevated as we thought. And when they had a go at them, when they were able to do that, there were real frailties. And I just think, you know, Liverpool's so much better than Manchester United. They should be able to exploit those weaknesses.
And if you think about the first 20 minutes of the second leg, where Rashford gets early on, you know, if that's Liverpool, they score.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very different tie. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think that City, disorganised probably might not be the word, but and they'll be typing on Twitter as we're speaking. But I certainly agree with the point that they're there to be got at.
I just think there's a basic difference in the intensity, and I think that's why we're seeing English teams do so well in Europe this year, that the Premier League at the top end really has, you know, kicked back on to a high level again. And the fitness and the speed at which those very top teams are playing is incredible and is difficult for any foreign opposition, because they're not, you know, especially in a league that has been reasonably easy for Barcelona this year. You know, I mean, there's Real Madrid yesterday losing to the bottom place team again, lost 10 times. So it hasn't been the toughest league campaign for them. And they're an ageing team in certain places. I use the word unshapen. What I mean by that is you've got Messi who's still at the top of his game, but I think you've got other players in that team, and it is quite well set up by Valverde, but other players aren't able to deliver what they used to be able to deliver, Luis Suarez being one of them, but even Sergio Busquets, this fantastic, fantastic defensive midfielder, but signs that the legs are just starting to go a little bit, that he's allowing things to happen in his watch that he wouldn't normally have allowed in when he was in his prime. And I just think Liverpool, with their energy, their commitment to press, the pace at which they can break, I think they can really cause them problems.
Mm. Johnny mentioned Luis Suarez. As a forward, one of the best. As a human being, is he tainted by the whole Evra episode that he went through at Liverpool?
That's a really, really difficult question, because I think if you look around, certainly around English football, there are any number of people who are tainted by things that have happened on and off the pitch. We lionise Gazza, for example, and Gazza's domestic problems are very well documented. Tony Adams, John Terry. And so as far as Luis Suarez is concerned, as a man, I would agree, you know, he's reprehensible. But I mean, and it's quite interesting, actually, because this is the area where we do judge people's qualities either as men or as footballers, you know, which is obviously why we have Player of the Year awards. But I think as a footballer, he's peerless. He's right up there. 176 goals and 245 appearances for Barcelona. He's as close to a goal machine as you could get in Europe at the moment. I think he's not even a supporting act. They're a strike partnership. Mm. They live next door to each other. Their understanding is almost telepathic, himself and Messi. It's such a good debate, Mike, because it's hard to separate the two, but it's our job to separate the two. And when we go into press boxes, if he goes past four players and sticks one in the top corner, we have to judge him as a footballer at that point and not as a man. But at the same time, you know, he has done stuff in, you know, as a footballer that is utterly reprehensible. As a father, you know, I watch game with my kids and I think, well, you've got to cheer what he's doing, but I don't like him as a man. You know?
Suarez is he raises questions about sport and why we watch it and love it. For me, I've seldom been as conflicted trying to judge someone as him. I lived in Liverpool at the time of the Evra affair, and so many of my Liverpool supporting mates were incredibly conflicted about it as well. I love watching him as a footballer. Yeah. My goodness, what a brave and exciting, and particularly at that point when he was at his real peak, what a special player. I think I've interviewed him. I think he's somebody that would do anything to win, and that would include racially abusing someone. It would include biting someone. It would include handling the ball on the line in a World Cup quarterfinal. And that leaves you as the person trying to report on him and judge him. Where do you fit that in? You know, it's that old question about sportsmanship and the person off the pitch as well as the person on the pitch.
John, you've got quite a good insight into Liverpool. They would take him back even now at 32, wouldn't they?
Yeah, well, yeah, he wouldn't get back. Don't think he'd get in the team now. I don't think he's fit enough. But yes, he's still loved by supporters. Of course he is. I think at the time there was a lot of emotion in the city, and it was stoked, I suppose, by, if you think of Liverpool's history as a club and probably as a city, a city and a club that's been put upon unfairly by the outside world. And they've got a tradition of trying to defend themselves and defend their own, and I think that's incredibly important and admirable. But I felt that in the Suarez affair, it was channeled for the wrong cause. Yes, and Kenny Dalglish was part of that, let's be honest. Mm. I understand the reaction, we defend our own, but I think it was, as I say, they were defending the wrong cause. But yes, I think, you know, all in all, they were taken back, but I think supporters are a bit wiser and more sanguine about maybe what he is and what happened at that particular time. But as you say, there are so many tainted players out there that I don't know how many football clubs can start to afford to pick people on.
Because it is, it's a multi-dimensional debate, this, isn't it? And Darren, let's look at the other side, if we could, almost like the positive power of football and Mo Salah. Went to New York last week, voted in the top 100 of Time's most influential individuals in the world. What can he do beyond the game?
Well, my son is part of a Sunday league team, my 9-year-old son. And I was there, there's a Muslim kid on his team, and his father was talking about how inspirational Mo Salah had been, both to him as an adult and a father, and to his son. That's what Mo Salah's already doing. You know, a high-profile Muslim player in the British game, performing the way he is and conducting himself the way he is. And he used the platform for that Time interview to talk about some of the cultural issues that have affected and surrounded the Muslim faith for a long time, surrounding women and just kind of opened up a lot of people's eyes that wouldn't otherwise have been prepared to listen, in a position to listen, or ready to listen, And so he's already doing it. He's already doing it on the pitch. People say he's had a below-par season. Well, hang on a minute. He is, in 100 appearances, he's the fastest player ever to reach 69 goals. I think as far as he is concerned, if he's playing the way he is in a season like this one, which is supposedly very poor, just think what it'd be like if he had a full pre-season under his belt and it was at top gear. But, you know, I think a little bit like your previous question, this is the wonderful thing about players like Salah is the social impact that he's having, as well as the footballing impact. And we are in an era now where a lot of footballers have a social conscience and they're exercising their voices and their platforms, and they're using them to break down the barriers that have existed between different countries, different cultures, and different ways of thinking. And for me, Salah is just a magnificent ambassador for football at the moment.
Mm. And he can play a bit. But
he's not bad, is he? I mean, he had a little dip this kind of winter. I think he was tired. Incredibly draining year that he'd had.
Emotionally as well.
Emotionally as well, the whole World Cup, the Ramos thing.
Because we tend to gloss over that, don't we? Because, you know, Liverpool at the moment are metronomic. You know, they're winning, but winning with intensity. And that's got to take something out of people.
Yeah, and we need to look at individuals sometimes. There is the intensity of Liverpool, the relentlessness. I interviewed Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, who talked about when he was on the outside, when he was recuperating, it's only then that he realised how relentless the demands are on players, particularly Liverpool, where they're fighting on all fronts, they're expected to win, and they've got this incredible sort of intensity under Klopp about them. If you think of Salah individually, it's the nation that he carries on his shoulders, football mad nation, very young population of Egypt, going into the World Cup as the guy that was supposed to, you know, deliver everything for them. It's a complicated situation politically in Egypt. It's not straightforward to be the icon of that country. It just isn't, because of all sorts of the place of it's a secular state. So, you know, the Muslim faith and its place in Egypt is well, without trying to give a history lesson, it's difficult to tread that balance between being a devout Muslim, as Salah is, but in a secular country, and he's got incredible pressure on his shoulders. So for that not to be draining for him, for him to keep performing, keep scoring hat tricks every week. It's just such an unreasonable expectation. And as Darren points out, you know, 69 goals in 100 games, he's pretty much maintained the consistency of performance. Apart from that dip, he maybe hasn't quite scored the number of goals, but he's still scored, what, 23, 24 goals this season. Maybe we'll get above 25. And this isn't a guy that plays as a traditional centre-forward. It's incredible.
Mm. If you look at Liverpool, Darren, where are the potential weak spots?
Midfield. I think that's Barcelona's midfield is far superior. Keita will be the player that they thought they'd bought next season. There are signs of it at the moment, but I don't think he's quite there yet. Fabinho's been better than most people expected him to be. I don't think Henderson's got the industry, but maybe not the quality, if we're honest, of the Barcelona midfield. And so it could well be in midfield that they're superior. At the back, they're much better than they were. They've got world-class quality. Try saying that three times. In between the sticks in Alisson. Van Dijk is a worthy winner of the Player of the Year award because of his impact on that back line, the organisation. I've interviewed Van Dijk before, and he talks about the willingness of the players around him to listen. I've interviewed Gomez on international duty before, and he talks about the guidance that Van Dijk gives him that makes it very easy for him to fit into that tactical structure. But I just think that defensively, they're much better. Now, again, people listening to this, and they've got to listen to these people who listen to us, will say, well, what about in Europe where they've not been as strong defensively as they have been in the Premier League? But I think in the knockout stages where they played Bayern, I think they were much more aware. They've learned, and they are learning as they go in Europe, and they're learning from their mistakes. Robertson gave an interview at the weekend where he talked about the fact that they had been hurting from Madrid last season. And they're learning from their mistakes in that game and from that campaign. And that's why I think that, yeah, Barcelona have the superior quality in midfield, and that's why they're able to give Messi the platform to perform. But I think Liverpool, I just get the sense that they might feel that they've learned a lot from last season.
What have we learned about the sort of collective commitment to our teams in Europe? Now, I mention that because if you look at the Dutch Federation, they cancelled every Eredivisie match this weekend to help Ajax prepare for the Tottenham tie. Tottenham, OK, they had an earlier game on Saturday, but they still, basically, they're running on fumes now. Why aren't we better at helping our teams in Europe?
Well, I mean, I think we have to be realistic and understand what powers our football in this country, and it's TV money. So if TV money's going to be the driver, then it's a business. It has to service television. And I think that's the reason that it's much harder to... You know, the Dutch clubs... Well, Ajax get £9 million a year from TV. You know, it's nothing. So they can move things around in the Dutch league without this huge commitment to the broadcasters to worry about. Whereas in our country, that is the case. So that I think there is willingness on behalf of the authorities, but I think realistically, it's not going to happen. And I think clubs can't really argue about it, because what TV money does give you is the power to build a huge squad, which is what you should have done. Spurs, obviously, for different reasons, haven't been able to do that. But that's the compensation that you get from these big TV deals. So I find that I recognise the debate, but I actually think we look at it the wrong way, and we should understand what drives our football, and that's the starting point. I don't think the FA can do anything about it. And the Premier League is just the collection of 20 clubs. It's not a governing body. People seem to think it is. It's just the clubs, and the clubs have decided this is how we run our business. We get the money from TV and blah, blah, blah. So that's what it is.
Yeah. You were at Tottenham on Saturday, Darren. Were there worrying signs of distraction there?
Well, without sounding like Nick Clegg, I agree with John. because there were worrying. I would go so far as to say alarming. In the last 20 minutes of that game, the centre-half, Issa Diop, was able to outpace the Tottenham defence. Mikel Antonio was able to outpace the Tottenham defence. They were tired, and I've seen Tottenham a lot this season. They'd lost their legs were going all over the place. They just looked like a side for whom a long season had caught up. And that concerns me, because Tadic again at the weekend, spoke to Mike McGrath, gave a terrific interview in The Sun where he talked about the fact that they've had a week off.
Yeah.
And they last played last Tuesday, I think it was, and they felt fresh, they felt ready. Now, you could look at it in two ways. Maybe Spurs might feel battle-hardened and ready to go again with the enthusiasm and the realisation that this, for some of them, this may never come again.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, it could well be that maybe Ajax are so rested and energised and, you know, that they're rearing to go. But it did look for me at the weekend, certainly. And Pochettino admitted it afterwards as well. He said, you know, we're tired and stressed. Well, goodness me, a West Ham side has nothing come faster than Issa Diop, you know, and he managed to get past. And it was only through, you know, the fact that he's not used to it that he got into the penalty box and it wasn't really a shot, really. It was just an effort, a sort of cursory effort. But I think as far as Spurs are concerned, there were concerns, there were worries about that, that anyone of a Spurs persuasion should be alarmed by.
As you say, it's all about getting a big squad.
Yeah.
They had the chance, but passed on it.
They did. And it probably was the wrong thing to do. But, you know, you have to recognise also, they've been able to build this incredible stadium and maintain, you know, keep the balance books, keep the players over. I'm really reluctant to criticise Daniel Levy overall because what he's done is absolutely unbelievable over 15 to 20 years. But in this year cycle, they probably did need to add someone. Pochettino clearly thinks so. He makes veiled references to it all the time. And I just think it is catching up with them. They've had an injury crisis. They've been unlucky, but that's why you have a big
They need Sissoko to be fit, don't they?
Can I just add to that, though? I mean, it was very interesting because every time we do an interview, and we did one just before the game ahead of Palace, and it was supposed to be Daniel Levy gave a 10, 12 of us a presentation before that game. And we were all getting ready to write big pieces ahead of the match, and then Pochettino gave a little briefing to us where he says, it's all very well us talking about being a big club, but we've got to spend big money. Yeah. And so suddenly he'd completely upstaged him. And obviously by the end of that first win, he was like, I love Daniel Levy and Daniel Levy loves me and whatever else. But what is quite interesting about all of that was that in 442 magazine, Frankie de Jong at Ajax said, Spurs tried to buy me last summer.
Yeah.
Mm. And the only reason I didn't go was because I felt I needed one more season at Ajax before I moved to a bigger club. Now, I don't know how much Frankie de Jong would have cost at that point.
Yeah,
maybe
30 million, maybe.
Exactly. Not I mean, relative terms.
Good point, Dan. Look at Jack Grealish. I think they were very close to buying him last summer. Villa wanted over 20, around 20, and they wouldn't go to that. Now Jack Grealish has matured and is probably worth 40. So that's where you are. And Spurs used to be so good at those deals, didn't they? Just getting players just before anyone else tried to get them when they were on the way up, and they have stopped doing that.
But their recruitment department splintered, didn't it? Yeah. When Paul Mitchell went to Germany, and you know he was put on gardening leave for a long time. They didn't really adequately replace him. It's the off the pitch stuff that has an impact on the pitch, isn't it?
It is, and. I think we're getting more and more aware of that. You know, Norwich going up at the weekend was an incredible story, but the recognition that it's not just the manager, but this incredible work that Stuart Webber, the sporting director, that's being made. And I think fans are now getting much more aware of what it takes to build squads. Look at Liverpool, they hardly make a wrong signing. You know, two, 3 years of fabulous signings. Spurs used to do that. You know, there was a period where they just had this golden touch in the transfer market. And it was the Gareth Bales and the Aaron Lennons and you know, Dele maybe was the last one where they just plucked the talent that everyone was looking at, but they had the bottle to do it and do it at exactly the right time. Since then, the signings have sort of been your Llorentes and your Janssens and Sissoko that's worked out, but it was a World Cup player. It wasn't a sort of gem that they were unearthing. And I suppose if they're going to continue to try and make the books balanced, they are going to need to go back and find different recruitment people maybe to get them back to that sort of money ball thing that they used to be able to do.
Because the Ajax model is admirable, isn't it? You know, that team is assembled for around about 25 million euros. Marc Overmars is their technical director, been there since 2012, working with Edwin van der Sar on the principle that Man United are trying to apply, old players coming back, understand the traditions of the club. What can we learn from Ajax?
Well, I did the UEFA media day where the prospective managers who want to do the licence, they come and they sit in front of the journalists and we put them through their paces. Peter Schmeichel did it. Mm. And he talked about wanting to become a technical director in the same mould as Edwin van der Sar for very similar reasons, because he believes that if you have that joined up thinking at a club, people within that structure who know all about the ethos of the club, the profile of the players that you want to sign, the football you want to play. If you have that kind of joined up thinking, then you can produce a team like Ajax. And now, Daley Blind is a really good example of that, because when Daley Blind was at Manchester United, some people saw him as a weak link and would say, well, don't mind if we get rid of him. You'd put him in the Ajax side now, and he's part of a defensively organised, tactically sound, very well-balanced Ajax team that continue to surprise people, that underestimate them. And, he, you know, why do we think Spurs will get past Ajax? Because we underestimate them. Exactly. They're not the big name. But the fact is that within that structure, there are a group of players, A, that trust each other, B, that are young and dynamic, C, are well-organised. And so can we learn anything from them? Absolutely we can. If we stop being as arrogant as we are, if we stop thinking that it's about players that make teams rather than teams off the pitch and on the pitch that make good teams like Ajax, we can learn a lot.
And it's telling that behind Ajax, there's two incredibly successful former footballers in Van der Sar and Overmars, but very educated as well. You know, they've educated themselves too, so it's not just stepping off the pitch and doing that. But there was a recognition last year when De Jong and De Ligt and Van der Beek, Onana, were all the clubs in Europe were looking at these young guys. And Overmars and Van der Sar went to them, showed them the video, you can become legends at Ajax if you stay, give us one more year. But they realised that they also needed to back that up by giving the players something back. And it was signing Dusan Tadic and Daley Blind, because their knowledge of dressing rooms and what it takes to be a team told them that we can't expect these kids to do it by themselves. They're going to need just a little bit of an extra ingredient, probably some experience. And those two were incredibly important signings. And the chemistry is now there in the Ajax team. And it's a chemistry that takes you back to 95, when there was a similar vibe with Rijkaard and Danny Blind in a young team. And of course, that's what Overmars and Van der Sar remember from their playing days. Real synergy, as Dan said.
Yeah, there's elements of a crusade in this one, isn't there? And when you've got that emotional intensity, it's very difficult to stop. Can we look at the English game in a slightly different way? The gap that has developed this season between City and Liverpool and the rest of the top six, it's huge. What does that say about the modern game? Is this just a one-off, like maybe Leicester's title win was, or is it something which is a precursor of something to come?
I don't think it's a precursor of something to come, because I think that I don't believe the two top teams will gallop over the horizon. I know there's a sharp intake of breath, so...
No. It's a couple... we're getting big questions today. We're dealing with the big stuff. No groin strains today.
I'm flattered.
Put the world to rights.
I think if you look at Spurs, they're at a point now, it's quite a make or break point really, because I think Pochettino's future, and I know this is a dramatic thing to say, so I'm going to try to say it in as considered a way I can, but I think Pochettino's been quite strident about the fact that he wants more investment on a number of occasions, and I wonder if his future might rely on whether he gets that investment this season, long term. I think as far as United are concerned, they are trying to move away from commercial opportunities and sponsorship and trying now to build a team, a proper team. They've got the finance to be able to do that. Emery's job, again, relies on them having to build a team. I think they may have spent as little as they did in January because they want to go big in the summer. And, of course, schizophrenic Chelsea, who you know, footballing terms, who, you know, one season they may be all over the place, the next season. Now, obviously, they're going to be affected by a potential transfer ban. So for them, it might be far more difficult. But then that might lead to a reliance on the young players that go scandalously underused from their academy, who they could maybe now put a bit of faith in. So, no, I don't... Obviously, the two top teams will build from a position of strength, and Guardiola's looking to, you know, invest even more heavily in his midfield. But I think the teams behind could catch them up.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a gap. But if you look at the bit of the season I've almost enjoyed the most... has been Watford, Wolves, Leicester in this last period. You can see wannabe teams who want to bridge that gap doing fantastic things that you can imagine in 2 or 3 years' time joining, certainly catching up Manchester United, Chelsea and Arsenal in this, and this maybe Spurs as well.
I can see Wolves making the top four next season.
That wouldn't be out of the question, Mike. I agree. It depends how they invest, of course, but with the manager, with the talent that they've got. And I don't think Leicester potentially are that far behind. If the four of the big six that are underperforming continue underperforming, of course they've got the muscle to reassert themselves. But I actually think that there's a lot of hope for a more competitive Premier League in the next couple of seasons. Everton as well. I mean, I'm still not entirely sure about them, but I have to say, last few weeks have been pretty impressive, and of course they've got the potential as well.
Just to back up what you're saying, you know, people look at, for example, Liverpool. They were 25 points behind City last season, and they're in a title race with them. People look at Spurs. They spent no money in the summer, but they've got organisation and almost alchemist in charge of them to be able to get them to where they are. Nuno is a guy that's been looked at by a lot of clubs higher up the chain, you know, and again, he is somebody that the players buy into totally. As you say, George Mendes allows them to be able to get players they otherwise wouldn't even be able to have a conversation with their agents and other clubs about. So there are various reasons why those top clubs, why those clubs outside the top six would have a way of breaking in. And also, you know, you look at Arsenal in disarray yesterday. You know, the arrogance of some of the established order, that there is a balance of power that is shifting in the Premier League. And some of those clubs who were able to rely on victories, even on the strength of their name now, are not able to do so because this top division is so competitive.
That's, you know, we can't, you know, go through this without talking about the possibility of Brendan Rodgers doing Liverpool a favour against City. Yeah, Leicester's a club you know well.
Yeah.
What type of impact has he had there? And can he do it?
Yes, he can. He'd love to. He'd finally win a title for Liverpool, etc. he's had exactly the impact so far that he was brought in to have, which is turn this very talented young group of players into something more dynamic, more coherent, playing a sort of distinctive brand of football. I think Puel was trying to do some of these things, but the coherence wasn't quite there. Maybe the personality wasn't quite there. I think Brendan has taken a group that, you know, I saw a fan put on Twitter this week, the Manchester United first 11 beside the Leicester first 11, and said, well, which would you rather have? And there was an argument for saying, well, if I was building a club for the next 3 years, the Leicester one.
Yeah. Have they got the clout to keep Tielemans?
It's complicated because, unfortunately for Leicester, he's really put himself in the shop.
Everyone will be after him, won't they?
Spurs first in the queue, maybe. But yeah, everyone will be after him. He was already valued at about 40 million. It's probably 60, 70 now. What Leicester have got in their favour is they've got Silva on loan at Monaco, who's done really well, who I think Monaco want to keep. That might give them an in. Some kind of sort of deal, and he clearly enjoys playing in that Leicester team for Brendan Rodgers. So there's something there, but I fear for Leicester in that deal actually that he might just have played a little bit too well and got himself gobbled up by someone else. But you know what? There's other great talents in that club, and I think they will throw some money at it. I think that's one of the reasons Brendan came, that he will be allowed to continue building a team. And this incredible training ground coming on stream. So I think they'll continue to attract really good players and continue to grow as a team.
What about Manchester United, Darren? You know, you spoke about let's move away from the commercial side and let's remember we're a football club. There has to be a huge clear out there, doesn't there?
Yeah, I think there does. A lot obviously depends on the will of the players to leave, because if you're on fat contracts like Alexis Sanchez, for example, then the deal has to be right for you rather than for the club. But I think that...
Some of the wages they're paying is extraordinary. Like
extraordinary.
Rocco, £160,000 a week.
And this is why there is such a massive desperation to get into the Champions League, because if they don't, then of course they've got to keep trying to attract players by paying huge sums of money. The interesting thing was a conversation that Roy Keane and Graham Souness were having the other day, where Keane says, if you were a top player and you wanted to win things, would you go to Manchester United? Yeah. Not anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was fairly uncompromising from Roy Keane. But Souness actually ultimately had to agree with him, because I think if you look at United at the moment, there was a wonderful piece by Marina Hyde the other day where she wrote about, you know, when they've stopped focusing on their pillow sponsors and their this sponsor and their that sponsor and their other sponsor, they might want to start focusing on the football, you know. And at the moment, they have been looking in the wrong direction and not at the pitch. And they've been buying players to appeal to their stakeholders rather than to the people who actually matter.
Is it time to get the green and gold scarves out again? If you look at it, the Glazers, that leverage buyout has cost Manchester United £1 billion.
Yeah, it's cost them £1 billion. It's cost them supremacy in English football. Let's be honest, they continued winning under Ferguson, but, you know, I could have owned the football club and Ferguson would have kept winning. And they've allowed themselves, through lack of a coherent plan on the football side of things, to fall so far behind two teams that are the exact opposite in Liverpool and Manchester City. It's cost them a lot. And what can fans do apart from protest? I don't want to tell fans of any club what to do, but you know, I would sort of be inwardly applauding if I saw the green and gold back.
Yeah, at least you were applauding with your hands and not with clappers. They put clappers on the seats, didn't they? The tide of plastic in football is getting stronger by the week, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
There used to be a football club at Old Trafford.
Plastic, yeah, it's a good word, yeah. And you know, we see flags on seats and trinkets, and you know, I mean, so suddenly the half and half scarf isn't the most egregious sight when you go to a football match. Yeah, that's another thing, actually. You know, we've got to think about football as an industry, and you know, without getting too right on, there's an environmental thing as well. You know, you see a football stadium after everyone leaves, and it's just full of rubbish. Absolute rubbish.
Some would say at Chelsea, rubbish has been on the pitch. Sarri's talking about, I'll get you a title in 2 years. He won't be around to do that, will he?
Well, do you know the interesting thing? I saw that headline on the front of the Telegraph, in my opinion. It said, Sarri, I'll close the gap with the top by 2021. I was thinking, they want it to be done by next week, don't they?
Yeah. I think he means with Juventus. I don't think he means with Chelsea. Might win Serie A in 2 years.
I honestly think that there's almost a perfect storm at Chelsea. Absentee owner, star player leaving in the summer, his heir apparent, the young player who could be taking over from McCallum Hudson-Odoi, injured, and goodness knows when he'll come back. Average team. If you look at the form guide, yes, they've won away from home, but the teams they've won against are being fairly weak. As soon as they've come up against any sides that are fairly decent, well-organised, they've come unstuck. I was at Chelsea on Monday night for the Burnley game. Burnley are well-organised and did what Burnley needed to do to get the points. I have not one iota of problem with that at all.
What about the Europa League, Johnny? They've got Eintracht Frankfurt, fantastic fan base. Not a bad team. If you look at it, they've beaten
team at all.
Marseille, Lazio, Shakhtar, Inter, Benfica to get to the semi-finals.
Yeah.
They'll fancy their chances as well. When we were talking about Liverpool earlier on, they'll fancy their chances.
Of course they will. They've done well in the Bundesliga in terms of their expectations. They've got some decent players, particularly in the forward areas. You know, I like Rebic, who was very good for Croatia in the World Cup. If they've done their homework on Chelsea, we'll see a team that's really plummeted in terms of since December, in terms of good performances. Even managed to make Manchester United look half decent at football on Sunday. They will fancy it, and anything other than Chelsea at their best, I think, will not be enough.
Apparently, the coach, Hütter, I think his name.
Yeah, the Swiss guy.
He's got a well-organised defence. He's got a very dynamic way of thinking. He wants his teams to attack. Yeah. He doesn't want his teams to sit back, park the bus or whatever else. He'd rather lose 5-4 than 1-0. As well as Rebic, there's Sebastian Haller in their attack as well. Luka Jovic, everyone is raving about. They all want him because he's a goal machine. And this season, that they reckon, they've only ever won one European trophy. I think that was UEFA Cup in 1980. But as far as the club are concerned, they believe that this is a season where that might change. There's a real optimism around the club. There is a real feeling that this is a club that no matter who they face, that they can beat them because they're not reliant on any one player. The side is well balanced. The approach is the right approach for them. And I think whereas Chelsea, to a large extent, rely on Eden Hazard, and if he doesn't make something happen, you kind of struggle to see whereas, because Higuain just looks horrendous at the moment. I think Frankfurt could get passes.
What about Arsenal? They were knocked out in the semi-finals last year by the eventual winners, Atletico. They got Valencia, more Spanish opposition. So, logically, Emery will know what's coming. Will the defence?
Well, it's a good. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, they are playing in the Unai Emery Cup, so they might have half a chance of winning it. But that defence just defies description sometimes, and they seem to be in a phase of you know, it's like the United defence, but it might actually be worse. Every single person they put in is worse than the last one. You know, I mean, Jenkinson and Mustafi and. You know, I think Sokratis has been overrated this year. I don't see what the top-class player is there. Koscielny.
Go back to calling him Sokratis, not Sokratis. Sokratis. That's almost like a heresy.
Oh, I know, exactly. You know, Koscielny looks like he's on his last legs physically. And I have sympathy for Emery because he's been dealt a really bad hand in terms of that group of players. But it's a worse squad overall than United's, and he's having to do a similar job. But they haven't had much trouble in the Unai Emery Cup. He's shown pretty sort of firm grasp of what it takes to win it. And Valencia are no great shakes either. So I think it's there for Arsenal to win that one.
Okay. You know, big handbrake turn now. Let's look at the relegation fight. Logic says that Cardiff, who have to win their last two games, you know, realistically, won't make it. And probably they went down on last weekend at Fulham. What about logic? Do we have to obey that?
I think we do. Because I think if there was going to be a chance for them to do it, it would have been against a side already relegated. It was almost like a free hit. You know, their appetite should have been stronger than the Fulham side, who are in pieces. And, in, you know, a lot of the players will be well aware that Scott Parker believes that they're not right for the club and he's going to move them on in the summer. And yet Fulham were able to beat them. Sean Morrison, great chance right at the end. Should have put that away to at least get the point that would have kept them in with the hunt. Instead, he didn't do it. And for me, I think the right team is staying up. And I say that advisedly because I think it would have been a wonderful achievement for Warnock to stay up. But at the same time, I think the job Chris Hughton has done at Brighton, I am staggered. And I think it's a scandal that he doesn't even get linked with better clubs. You know, the idea that they could have got rid of him or they could get rid of him regardless of whether they stay up or not is a disgrace, really. Because
there's little whispers going around now that it wouldn't be a surprise if Chris Hughton left Brighton in the summer after keeping him up.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Well, I agree with Dan about the job he's done. My fear for him is that it's a club that's got a particular model, which is the owner is kind of in charge of recruitment and spent fairly big in their terms.
They brought in Dan Ashworth to do the overall big picture stuff, haven't they?
And they already had John Marling, a kind of director of football already. So there's a lot of people there doing recruitment and trying to build a club. And they spent, as I say, they bought quite a few players in the summer for reasonable prices by their standards. And the team hasn't improved in terms of results.
They bombed, actually.
Yeah. And what experience tells you is that when that happens, it's not the guys in charge that take the hit for it. It's usually the coach that gets blamed. We've bought you these good players and you should have done better with them. That tends to be how it ends up. I'd be sad if it was like that.
Well, the problem I have with that is that even if allowing for those players that they've bought, if you look at that side, it's the squad. It's an inferior squad to the players above it. And so for him to be able to keep them competitive and keep them in the division is a terrific job. And, you know, our colleagues who have been to games, and I know one particular one that he and I have had a bit of to-ing and fro-ing saying they haven't scored in however long, you know. But what do you expect Hughton to do? Open up and be ripped apart like the really naive Huddersfield? You know, Jan Seifert there is probably the most naive manager. He's no positive impact on that squad whatsoever. Now, if Hughton opens up and gets ripped apart, he's done for. What he's done is kept it tight, scrapped, fought, and eked his way to that little cushion that keeps him above Cardiff. For me, with that squad, fantastic. There's no pace in that front line.
No, not really. At all. And Glenn Murray's struggling, isn't he, at the moment?
He's 35, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, what a great career, but he is struggling. And after that, those two terrible results that they had, Bournemouth and Cardiff, Chris has managed to get a reaction, and he's done a very sensible kind of bit of coaching and just said, right, back to basics, and we're going to work and we're going to fight. And you can see the effort they're putting in, and that tells you he is still having an impact as a coach.
Okay. Just like to finish on, you know, we're in award season. You know, last night, PFA, Virgil van Dijk was their player of the year. Somehow Raheem Sterling was the young player of the year. You know, Raheem is been named this morning, you know, in the Football Writers Association as Footballer of the Year with Nikita Parrish. So you've got she's the female player of the year, so you've got Manchester City double. Just like to end, we've spoken a lot about Sterling in the past. How important is it? Because our award is about example being set as much as what you do on the pitch. He does set an example, doesn't he?
He does. I mean, I think the right decisions have been made for both awards, actually. I think Van Dijk's been the best player in the league, and the PFA award is about purely playing. And our Football Writers Award is about playing, but it's also about precept and example and the impact someone might have beyond the football pitch. And I think not only has Raheem been maybe the second or third best player in the league, but he has, whether he set out to do this or not, I think he has helped affect what feels to me like a bit of a sea change in our industry. I'm not going to talk for fans because I'm still not sure exactly where we are in terms of changing society. That's a big, big question. But in terms of our industry, when you've got the best black player in the country, best English black player anyway, making the statement that he did when he took the media to task after the Chelsea abuse, and has prompted rightly the sort of thinking and soul searching that needed to happen, I think that's really important. I wouldn't also be in any way complacent and say just because he's got an award and just because we've done a bit of soul searching, everything's fine now. Hopefully what he's done is started our industry on the first steps of a journey. You know, it's, as I say, a long way to go. But I don't know what you think, Darren. It feels that there has been a bit of a shift this year, and he's done it by his actions, and that's really important.
Yeah, I suspect those words will resonate with you, mate.
Well, absolutely, because I think Sterling has changed football forever. Certainly our industry forever. And I agree with what you're saying about we can't talk about outside of the bubble, but we can only talk about what affects football. And not only has he changed the industry and forced the industry to look at itself, but he's also empowered other people.
That's
you've
really
had
important.
A lot of other people saying what they wouldn't have dared to say. You know, for me, as a black man, black journalist, having been in this industry and heard a lot of people say some of the things they're now saying publicly in private, but too afraid to say them in publicly because they're worried about the impact it might have at work, with their club, whatever else. It's massively pleasing, because I think for too long people have had to be worried about the impact of being honest. And it's allowed a culture within our sport to fester that we think we're dealing with by saying that racism has no place in our society and, you know, doing all of the cursory things, but not actually doing anything about the problem. And I still think now, within our game, we are still labouring under the misapprehension that we're going to deal with the problem by other methods rather than the zero tolerance methods, like points, like closing grounds, like threatening clubs and fans that if you do this sort of thing, you will affect your club. But what Sterling has done for players is he's given them that voice to say, we're not having it. And I think in years to come, we may think about him like we thought about, well, like we think about Bosman, you know, in
a great,
such a strong way, because that's the measure of the impact that he's had on our game.
I agree. Virgil van Dijk is a modern colossus, Ron Yates for a new generation, if you like. Sterling, though, is a modern role model. Praise and prizes are nice, but he deserves, actually his status demands, action. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports-ad-free. That's amazon.com/sports-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.